CRJ227, this is the week 4 podcast for the summer of 2020. And this week, we are moving on to take a look at search and seizure in a little more directed way. I provide an article titled Changing Definitions of Search and Seizure in the forum. I also ask you to go back to and reread Map versus Ohio. I know that's been a couple weeks ago, but it's time to focus on search and the introduction of the exclusionary rule. And you may remember me mentioning and discussing the exclusionary rule a few weeks ago now. But that's going to be our focus. Now, you know at this point, heading into the fourth week, that the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution protects a citizen's and criminal suspects' right from unreasonable searches of their property and persons. It prohibits police officers from making unlawful arrests. An arrest or a seizure is an arrest. And we talk a lot about this, and it should seem straightforward. It may seem straightforward in concept. But the law on these rights is not necessarily so. We don't have a whole lot of time to cover this important topic in this course. Again, we really cover search and seizure in great detail, and some of you have taken that course in the CRJ 230 evidence. If you haven't taken that course, it's available fall and spring, so it's definitely a course you'd like to take. It's in this format, but we focus on these things in greater detail, especially the evidentiary things. We spend a greater amount of time on what the police can and can't do in this area in that course. But you're going to focus on that this week. And the cases and news items you're going to present and discuss this week will help bring those issues to light, identify those issues. For our purposes, I am going to comment on what the police can't do and introduce the exclusionary rule in this podcast and give you a few tips from my experience. So you may want to jot these down to help guide you in your review of the cases and news items and your discussions of the topics this week. Here's my list. The police may not perform a warrantless search anywhere you or the person they're searching has a reasonable expectation of privacy unless a warrant exception applies. Okay, you're going to see some of this language in the cases. The next one. If evidence is obtained through an unreasonable or illegal search, the police may not use it against the suspect at trial. Now, this is in fact the exclusionary rule. That evidence is excluded. The next one, the police may not use evidence resulting from an illegal search to find other evidence. Those of you from CRJ 230 or have taken CRJ 230 recognize this is the root of the poisonous tree doctrine. Illegal evidence can't lead you to legal evidence as a general rule. And you know from taking that course that there are some exceptions. The next one, the police may not submit an affidavit in support of obtaining a search warrant if they did not have a reasonable belief in the truth of the statements in the affidavit. Think about that for a second. The police may not submit an affidavit in support of obtaining a search warrant if they did not have a reasonable belief in the truth of the statements in the affidavit. think we're all aware of a recent case where a young woman was shot and killed by the police as they improperly or in error, as they claim, attempted to execute a search warrant. Now, errors happen. That's not what this is talking about. I recall a situation in Peoria where the tactical team went to a particular address and they had presented the affidavit in support of a search warrant to a judge with a reasonable belief in the truth of the statements. Problem was that they had the wrong address listed on the document. Somebody made an error. And they took the battering ram and tore the front door off the house of a little old lady who happened to be sitting there watching TV. Doing nothing illegal. They had the wrong address. It was a big embarrassment. Made the news. City replaced the door. Thankfully, the little old lady didn't have a heart attack. And nothing else came of it. But those kind of mistakes happen. Mistakes happen because humans are human. We have human error in anything we do. That's not what we're talking about here. Okay? It's where they don't have a reasonable belief in the truth of the statements in the affidavit. And that's another way of saying either they didn't do their due diligence or they did not. They knew that what they were representing was, you know, less than accurate. A lie, maybe, untruthful, however you want to couch it, but they didn't have a reasonable belief in the truth of the statements in the affidavit. The next one, unless there is a reasonable suspicion, remember our friend reasonable suspicion, that it contains evidence, illegal items, or stolen goods, the police may not search your vehicle. Unless there is a reasonable suspicion that it contains evidence, illegal items, or stolen goods, the police may not search your vehicle. If a vehicle has been confiscated by the police, however, well, then they can search it. They'll do an inventory search. So if they take possession of a car as a result of a lawful arrest, they are entitled to do and will do an inventory search. And, you know, there's various reasons for that, but one of them to keep in mind is that protects the owner as much as the police. That vehicle's most likely to be taken to a storage yard, and people have been known to break into storage yards. I remember we had a vehicle impound hearing, and the vehicle owner came to the hearing and didn't really dispute the reasons for the vehicle impound, but was upset by the fact that while the vehicle was in the storage yard of the tow operator, somebody broke in, stole the wheels and rims and the stereo system from the vehicle. So other things can come into play here. But if you go back in relation to the vehicle stop, again, there has to be reasonable suspicion that the vehicle contained evidence, illegal items, or stolen goods. There's something that flows typically then from that, the reasons for the stop or what they encounter once they approach the vehicle. We're in an interesting time, a few months post legal cannabis. A year ago, vehicle stops may have been made where once approaching the vehicle, the officer would detect the distinct odor of burnt cannabis. That's the language used. That would be the language in the police report, the language used in testimony, the language that is used based on their training, where they were trained to detect the distinct odor of burnt cannabis. And that may lead to an investigation. One of the things you may remember that I spoke of in the evidence course regarding vehicle stops is the likelihood that in a lot of cases people give consent to the search. So if they gave consent to the search, I don't need reasonable suspicion to conduct the search. The driver or the operator of the vehicle gave me consent to search that vehicle. So that's a whole other ball of wax. And then finally, unless they have a reasonable suspicion that the suspect is involved in criminal activity, the police may not stop and frisk. If they do have reasonable suspicion, they may pat down the outer clothing of the individual. If they're concerned for their safety or that the individual may be concealing a weapon. Likewise, if the individual has a backpack bag, some sort of something else on their person. Now this one, what is reasonable suspicion? Well, you've heard me preach a little bit, and you'll continue to hear me preach. For those of you wanting to go into law enforcement, those are the facts. And those are facts that better appear in your police report. And those facts better indicate reasonable suspicion that you'll then have to testify to. And in the day and age of body cams, and the fact that, you know, even if it's not on your body cam, it may be on a camera from a security view of a local business or a bystander taking video of your actions, what you say in your report better be consistent with what video appears. So reasonable suspicion has to be able to be documented, testified about, and consistent with anything that's going to possibly dispute or attempt to dispute your reasonable suspicion. And there's a whole lot here. And again, this is something that we cover in greater detail over a longer period of time in the 230 course. But the moral here is, when possible, seek a search warrant. But that's not always practical or available because of something else we've begun to introduce here: time and circumstances. Hence, we get exceptions for vehicle pursuit, for arrest, and other topics that, again, we cover in greater detail when we have more time to cover those in CRJ 230. The other thing to keep in mind, and especially with vehicles, is that consent issue. Consent can be given to conduct the search, and 9 times out of 10, the person gives consent. I have handled thousands of vehicle impound hearings. You know, long time before that, stopped vehicles. I can't tell you the reason, but people who absolutely are aware that something contraband, some illegal thing is within that vehicle, consent to the search. My personal belief is that they're, you know, in that state of mind, they kind of hope that if they say, oh yeah, search my vehicle, the police officer is somehow going to say, oh well, they must be telling the truth, I'm not going to go to that effort. But I'm not aware of very many police officers who take that opportunity to search the vehicle when they have reasonable suspicion. I'm having a lot of trouble with that right now, that combination today. But when they have reasonable suspicion, they're going to follow through. If they don't find anything, great. They're going to say, you know, I appreciate that, I thank you for your cooperation. You know, most officers, at least the ones that have been in courses like this one with me, I hope are doing what I suggest, and that you explain what you saw, what you were worried about, and then you make it very clear. You know, I appreciate it. I'm sorry that I had to inconvenience you. I had to act on what I saw. But it seems to me, in more occasions than not, when that circumstance comes up, the consent, something turns up. At least those are the cases I see, right? Because those end up with a case. Homes are different. People tend to be less willing to consent to a search within the privacy of their home, even if they're not doing something. What do you mean you're going to come in my house? This is my house. This is my castle. This is my place. You know, that's fundamentally, I think, going back to our, you know, our caveman days, you're not coming to my cave. it's a whole different situation. There's also a greater expectation of privacy in your home. A vehicle, you really have no expectation of privacy. You know, your vehicle you put out on the street, you operate the vehicle as a privilege, not a right. You're moving that vehicle around per regulations and the authority allowed through the state. Whole different ball of wax, whole different expectation. And the courts have been fairly consistent in protecting the rights of individuals within their home. In other words, if you're looking to search a residence, you should have enough evidence to make an affidavit, an application to a judge for a search warrant and obtain the search warrant just to be certain your search is valid and anything that turns up in your search becomes admissible at trial. So you really want to take that time when you're talking about a residence or a structure, a building, especially somebody's abode, their home. Now, I discussed the exclusionary rule a little bit before this week. I just mentioned it again now. The exclusionary rule prevents the government from using most evidence gathered in violation of the United States Constitution. It applies to evidence from an unreasonable search or seizure in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Matt versus Ohio tells us this. 1961 case. The case is 4 years older than me. It's been around a long time, but it still dictates the law in this area. So it applies to evidence gained from an unreasonable search or seizure in violation of the Fourth Amendment to improperly elicited self-incriminatory statements. So things you find, statements made in violation of the Fifth Amendment, given to us by our friend Miranda versus Arizona, which I believe had its birthday yesterday. It was recent. Yesterday, the day before, was the anniversary of Miranda versus Arizona. When I'm recording this, it's the 18th of June, so you can look that up if you choose, but I just remember it coming across one of my bulletins from the Justice Department. And then it also continues to evidence gained in situations where the government violated the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to counsel, also brought to us by Miranda. Now remember, as covered, this rule does not apply to civil cases. We're only applying this exclusionary rule to criminal cases. If the evidence falls within the scope of the exclusionary rule, and that evidence led law enforcement to other evidence, and that other evidence is something that they would not have otherwise located but for the excluded evidence, the exclusionary rule applies. And essentially again says, anything found subsequent by way of that excluded evidence is excluded as well. And that's the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine. You find the tree, you find it illegally. The fruit of the tree, be it on the tree or not, is also excluded. Now keep in mind, the exclusionary rule is a court-created remedy and deterrent. It's not an independent constitutional right. It comes from, like most everything else, an interpretation of the Constitution by the courts. Paralegal students know that every statute, every constitutional provision, the way we determine what they mean is when the courts tell us what they mean. We hear a lot of nonsense by people. You know, the Second Amendment gives me the right to have assault weapons. I can protect my home. No, read it. It's not what it says. The courts are going to interpret these amendments, statutes, and tell us how those laws apply. So keep in mind, the exclusionary rule is a court-created remedy, and it's a deterrent. It's not an independent constitutional right. Courts will not apply the rule to exclude illegally gathered evidence where the cost of exclusion outweigh its deterrent or remedial benefits. Now, what does that mean? Let's see if you find some of that language in the cases he come up with, and especially those cases that I think people are going to find. That very issue was raised by the government, by the state. Finally, keep in mind the exceptions, especially those we've discussed of good faith, independent source, and inevitable discovery. So in other words, there's exceptions to the exclusionary rule. And again, these are going to be raised by the state, right? The defendant's going to say these items are excluded because it came from something that was illegally obtained, evidence that was illegally obtained. But the government's going to say, well, you know, no, there's no connection. Good faith. It came through an independent source. It didn't come from that poisonous tree. It may look like it. It may be fruit that came from or fell from that exact thing. It may appear on its face to be directly related, but this came through an independent source, and then you have to document who that independent source was. And then the last one, inevitable discovery. But for the illegally obtained item, now excluded, this item would have inevitably been discovered. It would have surfaced on its own, even without that thing or evidence or testimony or whatever it was, statements that were illegally or alleged to be illegally obtained. Now, again, that's a lot of complicated stuff covered in 1 week. Those of you who have had CRJ 230 are going to have an easier time with this week. Those of you who haven't, you're going to have an easier time with the exclusionary rule when you take CRJ 230 in the fall or next spring. Either way, it's good stuff. The cases are interesting. There's a lot to discuss here. And guess what? Like everything else we do, it's ongoing. It's ongoing. It evolves. And especially when we think about technology. So, pay attention to all this week. Now, how does it coincide with our intention to really make sure that you're well prepared on use of force? Well, here's how. Go back and review the case that you presented. I'm going to guess that in some way, something that I just discussed was an issue in that case. Either the circumstance revolved around a vehicle stop, the circumstance evolved out of some sort of allegation of reasonable suspicion to stop and frisk and further investigate the activities of an individual. It could have been in pursuit of an arrest. Somehow it's related to the things I just discussed. And if you don't see that, think about that very statement and go back and listen to this podcast again. I mean, it's not that long, probably 24, 25 minutes. The more times you listen to it, the more times it's going to stick in your head. And people, I don't want anybody who's taking my classes to end up in any circumstances on either end of the types of things we've seen in the first 4 weeks of beginning the week prior to the semester beginning. I do not want to see that. I think about it and pray about it every day. I don't want you to be victim to it, and I definitely don't want you to be a perpetrator in it. Because if you follow the law and you do the thing that many of you have heard, and I'm going to offer for the first time now, for those of you who haven't heard it, you'll be okay. Now, that thing is when the circumstances get real. When the moment becomes heated, when the pressure becomes high, when you're in the pursuit, or you're determining reasonable suspicion, or you're trying to effectuate an arrest and things go awry, you take a big, deep breath. You get oxygen to your brain. You count 1001, 1002, and you focus in on what you're doing. And you recall what your duty is, and you recall what your rights are, and you recall what it's going to take to get yourself and anybody else in that situation home. So that's what I want you to focus on as you look at that part of our summer-long discussion. I don't have that on the forum, so this is a little assessment to see who's listening to this podcast or not. Stay safe. Please don't get the Rona. I'm really scared again this week that, you know, we think it's going to open up. And from what I'm seeing in Houston and other places around the country, my friends, I had a conversation with, you know, I think I've alluded to, my best friend is in the DEA. He's in another country. That country's shutting down. My worldview, my national view is be safe. Don't let me catch you at the Hy-Vee. You don't got a mask on. I'm trying to argue with the clerk because why is she standing behind a piece of plexiglass? Stay safe. Do some good work here. We're heading into the fourth week, halfway through. Thanks.